Hey Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And we have an old friend on the show, a Mets podcaster from way back in the day, but also a current Mets podcaster. He'll tell you more about that in a little bit. Say hello to Ted Berg, everybody. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Good. It's always nice to have Ted on the show.
It is always nice to be on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a minute, but it is nice to have Ted back in the world of doing Mets things.
It's been a minute. I think the last time I came on was in like after the 2019 season. And so in some ways it's been a while, and in some ways that's like that just happened, and because there's been no time has moved forward really for all of one of those years.
Yeah, I want to say maybe the last time you were on, I think you were actually subbing for Chris. I think Chris wasn't here last time you were.
That's right, yeah.
So it's been a while since you and Chris have been on the pod together. But
I think I filled those shoes admirably.
I think you did as well. I remember recommended.
I would say I was Wally Pipped, except you didn't stick around. So
I want to say you talked about like a ska record, maybe. Awesome, you were certain. On.
And so... oh no, what I recommended it was a funk soul jam band type record. It was like a jazz thing. I think it was the Stanton Moore album.
Oh, okay.
And I only know that because I went back to try to find out, because I was like, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I don't want to say the same thing I said last time, so I got to go back and see what I said last time.
I do have to say, I was going to try to save the topic for a little bit later in the conversation, but I just want to let everybody know that Ted's avatars we're recording is an embarrassing photo of Cole Hamels.
I have Cole Hamels photos for so many of my like images on various sites and whatever you call Skype communication devices, that I think that there are a bunch of people out there who just think I look like, especially people who don't know what Cole Hamels look like, just think that's me.
I mean, there are worse looking guys to be confused for.
Good looking guy, you know. Yeah. I mean, all the, you know, I mean, some of the style choices aside, or I guess, you know, no more power to him. They wouldn't be mine, obviously, but yeah, you know, handsome man. I'll take it. You could do worse than Cole Hamels.
We'll get into it a little bit more, but tell the folks what the name of your podcast is, and we'll dig into it more, but give them a little tease now.
Yeah, so I am co-hosting the Metrospective podcast from The Athletic with Tim Britton, a guy probably Mets fans know pretty well, who's the Athletic's Mets beat writer.
And like I said, we'll get into that a little bit more later. But, you know, there is some news in Mets land today. After throwing a successful round of live BP, Carlos Carrasco tweaked his right hamstring while doing some calisthenics or some just general conditioning work, and looks questionable for opening day. Now, he was already dealing with a sore elbow. He had a bad reaction to his second COVID vaccine, and he showed up late to camp. So calling him like a lock for opening day was probably never really accurate, but it seems now like he is really not aligned for opening day. Ted, since you're the guest, we'll start with you. How worried are you about Cookie's just general situation right now?
I mean, he's a guy who I don't think they would be counting on for more than 150 innings. And so I think, you know, he's been able to pitch and pitch well at various points for long stretches. But he's not been a guy who is like that, you know, every fifth day 200 inning horse by any means. And so I think you just hope, okay, maybe this is his injury for the year, and it puts him on the sideline. It gets him a late start, but then he stays healthy. And so the optimist says, okay, well, at least we're getting it out of the way early when everybody else is healthy. And then, of course, the pessimist says, like, all right, here we go. We're not going to see this guy.
Chris, do you have any hot take here?
No hot take. I guess I would say it's just a little more concerning than it was, you know, a few days ago, with kind of feeling like, oh, maybe he'll make his first start on April 15th. Now, you know, depending on the details that we get, maybe it'll be May 1st to May 15th, somewhere in that range.
I just want to point out, though, we're all sort of still in a very, like, 1994 through 2020 Mets mode, where we're just hearing that he tweaked his hamstring and assuming that the truth is way worse than that. But like, maybe right. It's different now. We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that unknown. And then I think there's also, adjusting back to a 162 game season, where time has been totally warped for us since the last time we had one of those. And, you know, to have this sort of minor injury situation feels like a bigger deal, maybe because we just had a 60-game season and any injury was so significant. So I guess my optimism is just that when he's able to pitch, I expect that he'll be very good. And he's flown under the radar a little bit. It's a point that I like to make with Noah Syndergaard, that not that he's flown under the radar with Mets fans or in baseball in general, but you just look back at how good these guys have been. Both of them have been in that upper tier of pitchers, even though they might not get mentioned in the same breath as Jacob deGrom and Clayton Kershaw and, you know, a variety of others.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the reason that the hamstring slightly alarms me more than the elbow barking is that you hope he wasn't overcompensating for the elbow and that's why he hurt the hamstring. You know, that tends to be a thing that happens in baseball where something is bothering somebody a little bit and they're adjusting their workouts accordingly and then wind up hurting themselves again. So I would hope that this doesn't mean that his elbow was worse than originally reported, and therefore that's why this happened. But if these are two separate incidents, I can speak, then I kind of feel like what Ted said maybe is right on, which is, you know, if he's going to get hurt this year, maybe this is the injury, and then he'll take it slow and come back relatively, you know, strong after this. The good news of this is that for the first time in recent memory, the Mets actually have starting pitching depth. And so there are a couple of guys who were probably going to be making the team as bullpen pieces or start the year in AAA who now have a shot. We've talked on the podcast before about all these guys, but to me, it's really between Joey Lucchese and Jordan Yamamoto. Do either of you guys have a strong stake, like in the Jared Eichhoff sweepstakes, or do you guys pretty much agree that those are the two names we should be looking out for?
Is there like a Jared Eichhoff lobby out there?
I don't know. Let's find out.
I'm not. If he proves himself the guy, then it's not like I'm going to, you know, go to the mat for Jordan Yamamoto. But I don't know. It seemed to me always like Lucchese might have had a leg up over Yamamoto. I don't know if that's right or that's just the way I've read it, but no, I have no strong feelings. This is a weird thing to say, but it's like, it's a bad thing to say on a podcast. Like I kind of just with a decision like that at this point, the Mets are, you have to just, they're just working with so much more information than I'm ever going to get. And so like, you just kind of have to hope they're not screwing it up and they're looking at the right stuff, because like, I don't know from Joey Lucchese or Jordan Yamamoto. They've both had some success. Neither is a Cy Young Award winner, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think Eichhoff is definitely a significant step down. And this is something that came up last week too, when we just had that little bit of news on the elbow soreness for Carrasco. But to be in a spot where we were all very happy about the depth that they put together for this starting rotation, and then have to go to it immediately, I don't see that as like panic mode yet. And I know some Mets fans might instinctively, as Ted mentioned a few minutes ago, go to that. But I will say I would go to the mat for Jordan Yamamoto's dog, who has a criminally low follower count on Instagram.
I got to look up. Hold on. We got to pause the show while I look up his dog. What's his dog's Instagram handle?
Let's see. I should have that ready that before I mentioned it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can write Jordan Yamamoto's dog and see if that works.
Yeah.
I'm going Jordan Yamamoto, and I'm looking if he has linked to it on his Instagram.
That's a good call.
The puppy purr. THEPUPPI. The pup piper. I can read. Underscore.
I'm just going to go to Jordan Yamamoto's Instagram. I think that was the right call.
It's not on there.
Well, that's why he doesn't have any. That's why he doesn't have a following, right? Yeah, he's got
his
a
most recent photo has the pup piper.
Mystery solved. Mystery solved. If he needs a social media manager for his dog, I am unemployed.
It's a golden retriever. Yeah, it's the pup piper and then an underscore, Ted.
I see the dog. Like, do I need to see the Instagram if I'm just on Jordan Yamamoto's Instagram page? Look, no. It's a good dog.
Yeah, it's a good dog. I will say that the pup maybe balances out the churv for me. I do love a new pitch. I love a portmanteau. You know, churv is an inherently good thing on a lot of levels. But he, as far as I know, Joey Lucchese is dogless. Now, if it turns out he has a cute puppy, I think I have to go fully into Lucchese territory here. These are the hard-hitting things we talk about on the show.
Yeah, no, I think that's. I'm sorry, I'm lost in Jordan Yamamoto's. I'm like watching this dog develop backwards through time because I'm scrolling downwards through Jordan Yamamoto's, like looking for anything that isn't like him on the beach with his wife or his partner, or him with the dog. Like, it's a very repetitive. I'm looking for something more interesting out of Jordan Yamamoto's Instagram, to be honest, and I'm not getting it, so I'm just going to click away. So another point for Joey Lucchese.
Can we talk about the churv for a second? I feel like I cannot remember the last time that somebody invented a pitch. Is this the first in quite some time that you guys can remember?
So Corey Kluber, I think, will not label his breaking pitch because it's sort of like in between like that. Joe Musgrove, that guy on the Pirates now, he throws a pitch that no one else throws. He throws like it's like a fastball that he throws with just one finger on the ball or something. He has like a weird sinker pitch that is his own, I believe.
Then
for me, every time I hear it, all I can do is put it into the title of Trouble with the Curve. So I'm just looking forward to writing a headline on a recap or a Mets Morning News or something that says Trouble with the Curve. That's my level of analysis right now.
that would be a New York Post. If the Curve catch, you need New York Post readers to know what the Curve is. So you'd need that to become a pretty well-known term first. So I guess if you want that, like, we got to start beating the drum for just everybody knowing what the churv is. Joey Lucchese does have a puppy.
Oh, look at that. Okay. I am hashtag Team Lucchese. Official.
I'll stand up for Piper, even though I couldn't read his name.
I have joined your podcast to surf random Mets Instagram feeds. I guess he also hangs out with Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer sometimes. There's a photo with them. I'll say better Instagram than Jordan Yamamoto.
Okay. That's a hot take that you only get on this podcast. This is a crazy tangent, but I'm gonna go on it anyway. I feel like if the Churv were to take off, he would host SNL and they'd have to work the Churv into every sketch. Like, do you guys remember there was an Olympic like snowboarder who hosted SNL like in the early 2000s, and he had a move called the dinner roll. It was like a big deal at the time, and like every fucking sketch in that SNL episode was just about the dinner roll. And I feel like SNL loves a like kitschy name of a sports thing. So if Joey Lucchese takes off this year, let's start the petition to get him on SNL.
Yeah, I think that would be like, that's like one of those good, like if Joey Lucchese is gonna host Saturday Night Live, something has gone very right for the Mets.
Yes. So let's hope that happens. But yeah, I mean, I guess let's talk about them as pitchers for a second. I feel like both of these guys are probably considerably better than Rick Porcello or Michael Wacha was for the Mets last year. And so I think whoever gets the gig is probably going to be, you know, okay. They're not going to likely light the world on fire. They're probably going to be your prototypical fifth starter, you know, somewhere hopefully, you know, below a 5 ERA, giving you innings. I saw a couple of people stumped for having them actually piggyback together, because Lucchese is really good two times through the order and then falls apart. So maybe you start him for the first two times through, then you bring in Yamamoto. And I am all for the Mets doing more interesting things with their starting pitching, with their pitching in general. So I would be totally on board with that. I don't know if Luis Rojas, as a new manager, if that is, you know, there was some talk last year that maybe he was overwhelmed at a few points with sort of the more complex pieces of managing. So I don't know how he would do with keeping those guys, you know, keeping their workloads up in between starts and those sorts of things. But I would be on board with a piggyback situation. Do either of you guys, and I realized last time I didn't say who should go first, and so you both start at the same time. So Chris, do you have any strong feelings on a piggyback situation?
I like it. I think it would be a good use of the 26th spot on the roster, which was set to be introduced last year, and then COVID happened, and it's still happening. But yeah, no, I'd like it. I think what makes it appealing to me is that the bullpen seems so shaky, aside from Edwin Diaz and Trevor May right now, where, like, I'm sure a couple of the random dudes will be decent, but if you're putting together an 8-man bullpen, and on paper you trust 2, maybe 3 of them at the start of the year, you start to get into a situation where you can be tempted to burn guys out. So a piggyback also sounds really good on paper, and I don't know if it's realistic to expect that anybody could ever really pull it off, but the ideal scenario there is to truly devote that game, that spot in the rotation, to those two guys doing everything they can to pitch the entire game. So whether it's one of them pitching 4, 5, 6 innings to start and the other one finishing that game, or, you know, a little more dependent on the opponent or anything, it's something that I feel like I would love to do in OOTP or, you know, in a video game, and I could be strict about it, but those results don't matter to the actual Mets. So I don't know. I'm all for going into the season and starting things that way. I just don't know if my expectations are realistic.
Ted?
I mean, I am like a sort of a zealot for changing the whole way pitching staffs are constructed. Of course, I think they should. I think a piggyback would be cool, but like I would, I think Chris's idea of saying like, okay, these two guys give us 9 is one way of looking at it. I think another way would be like, and again, there's a lot to this, and pitchers are human beings, and baseball players are creatures of habit. So it would take more than the Mets are going to do in the next 3 weeks to change players' philosophies, I think. But like, I would love to see a team that said like, yeah, okay, every fifth day we are piggybacking Yamamoto and Lucchese, but we're counting on them for you know, 50 pitches each. Not you know, it's not a dual start. It's like a short outing, and then you have like, and then in that situation you say like, and then we have them on their throw day, and then so like on the third day then they're both available out of the bullpen for an inning. Like I feel like pitching is still just like a long way from being optimized fully, and I think it's come so far recently, like it just the rate of change, right? Like, you know, when I mean, you guys have been doing this for a while too. Like, it's just not that long ago when I was like, can you believe the dedication to the capital C closer and the, you know, the eighth inning guy? Like, we, you know, complaining about Jerry Manuel and all of these like proscribed bullpen roles. And now, you know, we've seen like teams like the Rays and the way the Red Sox used their pitchers in the postseason a couple of years ago, and Andrew Miller. Like, there's every year after year, there's examples of wildly new approaches to how to get through 27 outs. And so, you know, obviously it's one thing in the postseason because guys don't have to have like they're not pacing themselves, but I want to see teams do more in the regular season to to mess with this, like this weird, like why is it a 5-man rotation where they all throw 100 pitches? Like, is that the human limit? Is that it? You can throw 100 pitches once every 6 days, or is it like this is just what they've settled on and what they've gotten used to? And guys could just as readily throw 60 pitches every 3 days. And I don't know. I think there's a lot to it, and I wish I could start a baseball team from scratch and just be like, there's no such thing as starter or reliever here. We're going to go about this a whole new way.
Have you read that book by Ben Lindbergh, and I forget who his co-writer was, The Only Rules That Has to Work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so kind of that experience.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
We don't have to review that book right now, but just, you know, a similar idea.
Mine would be a major league team.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
You know, I would be in charge of this. Is the real deal someone's giving
okay.
me here.
Okay. So there's an expansion club that you are just given, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is the.
Liked your embarrassing photos of Cole Hamels that you ripped off the internet. Now you're in charge of everything here.
And that's like the ethical way to do it, because at least they're making major league salaries and all that. If you do it with a minor league team, you know.
Yeah.
You feel like you're jeopardizing people. Even
I don't
more.
Know. We're still like violating. There are all sorts of murky ethics in what I'm doing. Like, not, you know, because like we're going to try to get them into wearable tech and tracking, you know. So there's a lot. There's a lot I'm doing that's sort of shady and underhanded. But I think over the table is just like coming to the guys straight up on day one and saying, you're not a starting pitcher anymore. You're a guy who throws as many innings as we can possibly get out of you in a healthy and responsible way. Because like Jacob DeGrom throws twice between starts, and that deeply bothers me. Like that there's, and I know he needs them. I know he needs them to get better. I'm not saying like, oh, they need to ride Jacob DeGrom harder somehow than they already have. But it like disturbs me on some like deep fan level that there are pitches that Jacob DeGrom is throwing that are not counting in baseball games. Like, I want every single one feels precious to me. And like they should just kind of find a way. Like, then, okay, so if he's throwing 30 pitches on his throw day, even if they're at 75%, they're better than what any, like, we've seen the guys the Mets have had, right? Like, this is Jacob DeGrom. Jacob DeGrom is 75% of Jacob DeGrom is still, like, the third best pitcher on the Mets staff. So if that's what he's doing, like, I just let him throw the first two innings. I don't know. I want more Jacob DeGrom. That's really the whole point of it.
Support for this episode comes from Locker Room, the app that's changing the way we talk sports. Locker Room is a sports fan's dream come true. It's a live audio platform that lets you connect with other fans, experts, and even the athletes themselves. Locker Room makes it easy to start your own conversations. Talk about the latest rumors, takes, news, and teams you care about most. Join massive watch parties for all of your friends to react together in real time as you celebrate a buzzer beater or suffer the agony of a crucial bricked free throw. And if you've got a bunch of supremely spicy takes you'd like to fire off, you're in luck. You can even record the conversations if you want and release them as a podcast. So it's time to start thinking about catchy titles. It's all totally free and available at the iOS App Store right now. So go download it today. Locker Room. Changing the way we talk sports.
Well, that segues us really nicely into the ungodly spring training that he's having. We have to put out the usual caveats. It's spring training. He's not facing the best lineups, small sample size, etc. But, I mean, it is unbelievable to watch what he is doing in spring. He gave up a run on Tuesday, and he looked like he was going to walk into the dugout and punch a hole in the earth. He looked so angry. This guy is just locked in a crazy, crazy way. And I don't really have a question here. I just want to say, like, isn't this awesome? Because I think it's very awesome.
I think it's extremely awesome. I also think, like, I just brought this up with Tim on the podcast the other day, like, I think that now, and it's feeling like this is like a full ham year for Jacob DeGrom already. And Tim said that we were doing over-unders, and he said 300 strikeouts, which is like such a ridiculously bold number to set as the over-under. And yet I was thinking about 300 strikeouts for DeGrom too. And I think also, like, the now what we're watching with DeGrom is like, if he does this for one more year or two more years, he's a Hall of Famer, you know. And I think that when a guy comes up at 27, you sort of assume that's out. But now you start comparing DeGrom to like Sandy Koufax. It's really not that far off. Like it's a short run of dominance, but he's been so dominant, and there's no sign that it's going to stop anytime soon.
Yeah, the way he looks like he's still potentially improving, and adding velocity, especially as a guy who seems like if and when, and there's a when somewhere, the velocity started to trend in the other direction. He seems like a guy who could adapt to that pretty well.
But now when the velocity trends in the other direction, he's going to be down to 101.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if either of you guys saw they were talking with Mets pitching coach Jeremy Hefner on the broadcast. I think it was Tuesday. And he was basically saying that he just thinks it's because DeGrom has less innings on his arm than other guys do, because he didn't start throwing until he was in college. And when he started throwing in college, he was a closer. And so it's not like he has, you know, 20 years before getting to the majors of throwing, which, you know, some guys, before they get to the major leagues, have been throwing baseball for at least 10 or 15 years. He didn't have that. And so just the combination of his incredible work ethic, his unbelievable focus, and the lack of innings that are on his arm, Hefner seemed to believe, like, you know, this, that his velocity uptick is something that can continue a little while longer. I mean, it can't continue forever, right? He's not going to be throwing 106 or anything like that. But, you know, his average fastball velocity is, you know, I want to say it started at like 94 and we're up to 98.5 now or so. That's just, you don't see that. It's just a sight to behold.
Especially that it's been across like his early 30s. Yeah, it's very weird. And it's awesome. I think that I would almost say, I don't know that I, like, obviously Jeremy Hefner is the Mets pitching coach, and I am a guy sitting in a pillow fort in an empty apartment next to my own, right? But, like, I don't know that I buy that it's like a fresh arm aspect of it, because DeGrom had Tommy John surgery in the minors, right? So, like, he did damage to his arm at some point. I would almost be more likely to believe, like, that a general, like, relative inexperience as a pitcher, like, that there's in some way he might be still on the improvement curve, because, like, maybe the mechanics are just getting all that much better from more and more reps, and maybe Matt Harvey already had all those reps when he got to by the time he made the majors, and DeGrom is just getting them now. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to know why DeGrom is aging seemingly in reverse, but it's a glorious thing to watch. 300 strikeouts, that's a big number, though. I don't know about that. I mean,
if he kept up his 2020 pace for a full season, I think he gets there. It jumped up a lot last year, his strikeout rate.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Oh yeah, no, just on the age front too. A couple of guys who weren't pitchers, one isn't a pitcher and still is active, but you look at this arc of the age he was when he came up and how good he's gotten to be. You know, Ichiro comes to mind as a guy who, he didn't play in Major League Baseball until his late 20s. And Nelson Cruz, who has a legitimate shot at 500 home runs. He's 40 years old, and, you know, he didn't really get regular Major League playing time until he was 28 and 29, 30. But those types of guys that come up that late and then are either that good or last that long or both, I think DeGrom has a pretty realistic shot of getting to that point of Hall of Fame discussion, which even a year or two ago may have been a crazy thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, Tim brought up David Ortiz in the same conversation that with the 300 strikeouts. And I think that's another, like, a guy who came up late, and you would say, like, 4 years into his career, like, well, no way this guy makes the Hall of Fame. And then when he's still doing it at 39, yeah. But my point with DeGrom is, like, I don't even think he needs to he needs to get 10 years of service time to get on the ballot or whatever, but I don't even think he needs to be this good for that much longer to have a Hall of Fame resume. Like, I think that just being this dominant is, like, if I mean, look, Sandy Koufax is the example. Like, people hold up Sandy Koufax as one of the great pitchers of all time, rightfully. He had six good seasons, you know, and a handful of very mediocre ones at the start of his career. So, I mean, I don't know. I think DeGrom is 1.5 Jacob DeGrom seasons away from everybody being like, okay, yeah, this guy's a Hall of Famer.
I mean, I can't remember the last time that there was a high peak guy who made it into the Hall of Fame. Like, usually the guys that make it in at this point, and I'm not advocating for this, but it tends to be the guys who play a very long time. You know, Sandy Koufax is the classic example of the high peak, but not a sustained, you know, 15, 20-year career. But I can't think of the last guy who went in with, like, a shorter, really dominant period. Could either of you guys pull somebody offhand?
Kirby Puckett, maybe?
Yeah, that might be the...
I mean, that's still longer than DeGrom, and he wasn't nearly as dominant. But he had a pretty short career.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was a different situation. Yeah.
That might be the
one
guy, though.
The one who didn't get consideration, really, but is my favorite Sandy Koufax comparison, is Johan Santana.
Yeah.
And it's weird. Like, the vibe around DeGrom is just clearly the best pitcher in baseball, and Santana had that, but he had it when he was, like, 24.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's definitely something for how you finish and all of that. And I don't know. Johan is forever somebody to be cherished in terms of Mets history, who I think was done a little bit wrong, not necessarily by anybody involved, you know, with the Mets or anything, but just freak injuries, and that was it. And I think that took all the oxygen out of his potential case. But he's the most similar to Koufax in, you know, in that sweet spot of being that good for several years, and then just not pitching anymore.
Yeah, I think the difference is that, like, people our ages, dads, didn't fall in love with Johan Santana the way they did with Sandy Koufax, right? Like, Sandy Koufax was just like, and Koufax had the World Series experience, and I think a few, like, a couple more Cy Youngs. Like, there's some hardware differences there too. But yeah, it's a good call. Like, it makes me sad that Johan Santana didn't get more Hall of Fame consideration.
Yeah. I think that with DeGrom, like, one of the things that you see every now and then as a Mets fan, I remember when David Wright was having his, like, you know, again, David Wright's a guy who had an incredibly high peak, but not a long career. I remember when Yankee fan friends of mine were like, dude, I would give anything to have David Wright on my team. Like, people who weren't Mets fans were taking real notice of him. And my Yankee fan friends all drool over DeGrom as much as we Mets fans do. And I feel like it's not a scientific poll here, but I feel like every generation or so, there's a player that just gets recognized by everybody in baseball as this guy is the man right now. And I feel like...
And it's not Jordani Valdespin.
Yeah, yes. Hey, I was at a Valdespin walk-off Grand Slam game, so I will always have a soft spot for him. But yeah, you know, there's just this acknowledgement of this guy is just the baddest right now. And it's so fun because DeGrom, like, on one hand, like, I wish that, you know, Marcus Stroman has so much fun on the mound that if Marcus Stroman pitched the way DeGrom pitched, it would be the most fun broadcast in the history of baseball, right? Just him laughing and dancing around, just having this. DeGrom is no nonsense at all. You know, they're very different players, but there's just something about the utter dominance of DeGrom that, I mean, I can't remember a Met player in a long time being that much of a surefire, just stud every time he takes the mound. Even Johan, because Johan on the Mets was not quite Johan on the Twins, unfortunately.
I mean, Harvey for 1 year, right? For the 1 year, it felt like Harvey was like that.
Yes.
Like one calendar year, basically.
Right. Yeah.
I'm actually curious for Ted's take on something that comes to mind with that just sort of universal admiration. So we're all, you know, similar in age, and we've all been Mets fans for a long time and followed all that. So I don't know. To me, it's like, okay, I'm getting a little older, getting a little more mature in my fandom. I can appreciate players like Giancarlo Stanton when he was on the Marlins, or you know, a variety of Yankees, whether it was Robinson Cano in his time there, or you know, whereas going back to you know, the late 90s, I despised all of them. And you know, obviously they were in the midst of a dynasty. But Ted, like, do you get a sense, is that accurate, that it's like, okay, my perception is changing and I'm appreciating other players more? Or do you get the sense that people around baseball, fans in particular, are a little more open to that?
To, like, respecting players other than their own? I mean, I think that it probably, like, it depends on the circles in which you traffic. Probably, like, I think that probably, like, I have had that experience as well. But I think that it's probably that, like, I'm 40 years old and, like, I just don't spend a lot of time with people who are like, I hate this guy because he's on a different baseball team, you know? And so, like, I think that that is probably something a lot of us thought in high school. And, like, I don't know. I would be curious. I don't know. When I think about, like, I have nephews who are 13 and 9 and they're huge baseball fans. And I don't know. I would have to ask them about their Mets fans. I would have to ask them about Yankees players and, like, what they feel. But, like, I don't get the sense that it's like that. And I think that there's a lot that's different about being a kid these days, you know, and maybe, like, there's a lot less negativity, and, like, a negativity I think is a lot less welcome. So maybe that's part of it, but maybe they're just, like, everybody has a little bit of a better perspective. Like, I can't imagine that my nephews don't think Aaron Judge is cool, for example. And me at 13, the way I was, I would have been like, I hate that guy. He stinks.
Yeah. I think that there's more of a sense now. Because I too have, my kids are too young to have any sort of real fandom on their own, but I have nephews who are big Yankee fans, and they'll often say to me, the Mets stink, but, and they'll throw like three players they like out there. So I think that there's still maybe team-related just trash-talking, but maybe, and maybe it's because just the transient nature of players. You know, the guys don't stick with the same team their whole careers the way they did. I mean, we never really, the three of us all grew up after free agency, right? But I still think that players probably change teams more now than they did 25 years ago when I was first, you know, really deep into my baseball fandom. So maybe that's why, too, is that, you know, you don't get too attached to guys on your team anymore, which is kind of sad, but just the nature of the game, and I'm not going to lament, you know, that. There's plenty of other stuff in baseball to lament. That's not one of them for me. So I do want to get something in before we run out of time with Ted here. So today it was announced by Governor Cuomo that both Yankee Stadium and Citi Field will be open for 20% capacity on opening day, and that number will seemingly rise as the season goes on. All three of us are one vaccine into the COVID recovery, but I Chris and I have a very specific stance on, as part of the Amazing Avenue staff, where we are two of, I'd say, the most cautious in terms of getting back to normal, and whether that's because of, you know, family conditions or just, I don't know what, we just tend to be a little bit more conservative when it comes to that. Ted, what's it going to take for you to get to a game at Citi Field this year?
It's a good, I want to go, you know, I really want to go, but I would say if, like, you know, I'll probably at some point pitch some freelance work. So, like, there's always the chance that someone hires me for something, and that would certainly get me out if it was something I was going to report in person. But as a fan, I mean, it's hard because, you know, I wouldn't want to go. I would want to bring my kids, and my daughter is 7 months old now. So, like, I don't want to mess around with exposing myself or exposing her before she's a year old. Like, that seems to be a benchmark of sorts. So I think it would just need to take, and again, I'll be fully vaccinated. You know, I get my second shot next week. And so I guess it takes a couple weeks for it to be fully in effect. But, you know, by mid-April, I'll be good to go. I just don't want to, we don't know yet, you know, if you can bring it home or whatever else. So it's going to take a much lower rate. Like, I hate to be, like, I seem paranoid or cautious about it or whatever, because it's not, that's not my way. But now I have kids, you know, I can't get my daughter sick because I want to go to a baseball game.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm in the same boat. You know, both of my kids have had seizures based on high fever, and so putting them anywhere near a virus that causes a high fever is a big fucking no for me. I'm not going to do that. You know, I can't imagine that.
Yeah, and yeah, to me, none of that sounds paranoid or anything. I think it's going to be interesting to watch people navigate this. I don't know. I'm excited that, you know, in the near future, we'll have the opportunity to do some limited things that we haven't been able to do over the last year. And then just sort of take it from there. You know,
I would love to see a baseball game at 20% capacity, like for the novelty sort of. But I've been to baseball games at 20% capacity, and they suck, right? Yeah. Like, that's not what I want to see. I want to see a baseball game at 100% capacity, right? Like, I don't want to see a baseball game with no one in the – like, a good baseball game, an exciting game with no one in the stands. Like, that's not what – I can watch it on TV. It wouldn't be any different. I want, like, the shaking stadium experience. And you know, we're not going to get that this year.
Right. Yeah, no, August 2019 was really the last time that I'm sure I went to some games after the Mets faded after that surge, closer to the end of the season. But those August games where it was just like, you know, holy shit, they're really going to do this. They're going to kind of come out of nowhere and make the playoffs, and who knows what will happen. And the place was packed. Standing room was packed. We had a gathering. Was it an Mason Avenue? Was it an Argish thing, Brian, that we did?
I think, well, I know you and I were there. I think we invited others too.
Okay. I think so. I don't know. Or maybe it might have been my birthday. My birthday was like right at the peak of that season. So it might have just been one of those like, hey, anybody who's going to the game anyway, since there's 45,000 people here, you know, we're going to be on the field level standing around. And, you know, we're like three people deep trying to, you know, find a way to look in and see the field. So yeah, Ted, totally. To go from that being a still pretty recent memory and probably like the third or fourth most recent game that I've gone to like a poorly attended April night game setup, except the poor attendance is spread out over the entire ballpark. You know, that's going to be weird. And I'm with you.
It's like, it's so weird how it operates on you that it now feels crazy that you went to a baseball game with 55, or not 55, but that's Shea Stadium, but, you know, with 45,000 people in the stands, right? Like, that's just, like, that's almost, it's, like, hard to believe now. Like, I was going to go to Curacao last year on, like, March 19th or something, and, like, now it's, like, really? I was going to go to Curacao? Like, that's impossible. Right? Like, I can't even get to New Jersey.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, this is going to somewhat contradict everything we just said. I had an opportunity last year to get to get media credentials and go to a game in the empty ballpark. I'm sort of mad I didn't. I mean, I'm glad I didn't take the risk for the sake of everyone's health, but it would have been interesting to see a game in that environment.
Absolutely. Yeah, I felt that way. And like, again, it was like a, you know, a grim backdrop to it. But like, there was a big part of me was when they had the Freddie Gray demonstrations in Baltimore and they had no fans at the Orioles game. Like, I really wanted to go check that out. Like, that seemed like something, not an experience you'd be able to get. Certainly, it didn't seem like an experience you'd be able to get like very readily right. In 3 years with empty ballparks. But at the time, it was like, wow, empty ballpark. That would be something to see.
Yeah, yeah. And we keep saying this on the show, but Chris and I are really lucky because we were in Port St. Lucie last February. So we got some live baseball in 2020. And I recognize how privileged that makes us for a lot of reasons.
But I mean, you got spring training baseball.
Yeah, but it was, I mean, how many
fans? It's better than nothing. Yeah, it's better than I got.
Exactly. How many fans would have killed for that, you know, come June when there was nothing going on and it seemed like maybe there wasn't going to be a season. It felt like, well, thank goodness I got to see some baseball this year.
I'm still shocked. I'm still shocked they got through the season as well as they did.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's
Yeah.
Because I've met baseball players. Like, I mean, you know, no offense, but like, there are a lot of guys where you're like, this guy's not wearing a mask.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think to sort of put a pin in this, I think for me, the rate would have to be really low. And they'd have to see if they said, if Cuomo said today, we're going to be at 20% capacity all year, no matter what, then maybe I buy a ticket in September. Because I would feel like the rates will likely be much lower, and there'll be plenty of room, and it won't be everyone on top of each other. But
are they going to be super expensive though?
Well, opening day is right on the secondary market. Yeah. It's funny, you know, similar to the idea of 45,000 people in one place sounding like a foreign concept now. The amount of time I used to spend on ticket websites for music and baseball and hockey was a lot. And now I'm like, oh, is StubHub still in business?
Yeah.
I'm curious what. Yeah, there's some $9 tickets for night games, but there's also a whole weird thing with everything they announced with, you know, if you're a season ticket holder or a plan holder, basically, your tickets don't exist, but you get credits, and you can use the credits to get pod seats. And I don't know. It's that $9 ticket that you see right now in StubHub might not actually exist in a week.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's weird. And to Brian's point, too, if there were a map to, like, okay, you know, if the daily cases and positivity rate gets to this point, then capacity will be this. But I feel like it's going to just kind of stay on that line for anyone who might be in a similar spot as the three of us. And I know there are other Mets fans and baseball fans out there who feel that way as well. But where those increases in capacity and the numbers coming down, it's going to be like this weird thing of like, okay, when are we hitting that sweet spot of that's where I'm comfortable. And like, I just can't see buying tickets more than like a few days in advance and saying, yeah, okay, yep, we got to that point. You know, 70% of the population is vaccinated. The numbers are very low. You know, I'm vaccinated and all that. But it just seems so hard to predict that right now.
I also feel like, you know,
I guess if I knew also like you, even if you're exposed to the disease with the vaccine, you won't transmit it. Like if I knew that was the case, cause I think that they think that there's a chance that that's true. You know, they just don't know yet. If I knew that, then I think I'd go.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, I mean, like Chris and I have for a long time bought standing room only tickets at Mets games when we go together and just kind of hang out on the concourse. Yeah. And I love that. But I feel like everybody's going to want to do that now because nobody wants to be stuck next to the guy who's, you know, aggressively eating his hot dog or sneezing into his shirt or whatever. Like that concept to me of sitting next to a gross person at a baseball game used to bother me like 10% of the time, but that would bother me 100% of the time now. I feel like I need to be reconditioned to be around people again.
I get so disturbed when people get close to me. It's like who the hell do you think you are? Like, are you really walking this close to me on the sidewalk? I'll punch you in the stomach. You know, right? It's just, yeah. So I don't know. I think we need like the whole world needs therapy for like getting back to normal human amounts of contact.
Right, and there's this aspect of obviously when things are going well, I love being at games. I've gone, you know, a couple seasons there when my wife, you know, back in the first year or two that we started dating, she had an apartment in Queens that I could walk to Shea Stadium. You know, so I've had years where I've gone to 38, 39 games in a year. It's something I absolutely love to do. But, you know, you go through this past year and it's like, okay, do I want to like be near this dude who's hating on the best players on the team and complaining about it? And, you know, you have that, like, do I want to endure that and take on some risk in the process. Like it's very easy.
If there was no risk, you could sit me in the middle of like pack me in a section of like the, like that like Beltron blamers, right? Like that whatever that happened to like the Greg Pomes guy, right? Just like all of that guy in me in a section, and like I would be fine with it if I knew I wasn't going to get sick and get members of my family sick. Like, I would really like to see a baseball game. It's not the fans, right? It's not the other fans. It's the fact that they might be, like, leaking virus.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Ted, before we get to our music picks, tell us about the podcast and what you're excited about going into the season.
I'm excited about the podcast. So yeah, we're doing right now it's weekly. I think we'll probably pick it up to two shows a week in the season. Don't hold me to that because, you know, maybe not every week, but I think that's the plan. I mean Tim and I don't know each other that well, which is kind of fun. Like he's someone I had interacted with online like way back when he was working on the Red Sox beat, and you know, someone I said hello to in passing at Citi Field, but not someone I've spoken to. Certainly the conversations I've had with him on the podcast are the longest conversations we've had. So it's sort of fun to like get to know someone in a public way, you know, in like a open forum like that. And it's gone well so far. I've enjoyed doing it. And it's a nice, at least I find like, it's a nice for me right now. And like, I really enjoyed writing about baseball for a really long time. I'm not especially moved to want to write about baseball every day right now, but like the podcast is sort of a perfect level of involvement for me where I can feel like I'm still like part of this world and talking about the Mets. And more than anything, like I think I can be, you know, when at USA Today and just in general, I think when you're reporting on baseball professionally, like you have to be a little bit hesitant to say you're a fan. You especially have to be hesitant to say, you know, I grew up a Mets fan and I've been a Mets fan my whole life, but now I'm kind of can just be a Mets fan, which is dope. So I'm enjoying that too.
And what day does the podcast drop at the moment?
Right now they're coming out on Wednesdays, but that's not necessarily regular. It's just that Tuesdays tend to be the best day for us to record. I suspect that'll remain true.
Okay. Well, everyone check it out. I cannot pronounce it. Metrospectives.
The Metrospective.
I feel like I messed it up when I tried to say it. But
like retrospective, but yes. Metrospective.
Yes.
It predates me, the name. but it is on, it is, if you, wherever you get your Amazing Avenue audio, unless you're getting it from the front page of the site, I'm sure that after you listen to the like 19 different Amazing Avenue podcasts, all of which are excellent, when you're like that desperate for Mets commentary, click on over to the Metrospective podcast and check us out.
There's always room for more Mets podcasts. We recently spoke to Trevor.
I know it's like clearly you're the Amazing Avenue going mantra.
Well, but like you know, we spoke to Trevor May recently, and we had kind of teased him because when he signed with the Mets, he said that the Mets have more podcasts than any team in the world, and I think he might be right. But you know, that's okay.
There's a lot. There's good ones. I don't know. I've only scratched the surface of the Mets podcast world.
Well, there is a seedy underbelly, so be careful with how you proceed.
Of course there is. That world I know. I know the seedy underbelly of Mets fandom, trust me.
You're from Long Island, after all.
I am very much from Long Island.
So, Ted, you're a guest. You get to go first. What is your music recommendation for our listeners this week?
I think I said the same was true the last time I came on. Like, I'm in such a bad way for finding new music because I almost exclusively listen to music when I work out. And when I work out, I almost exclusively just listen to, like, Spotify playlists that I've made. This is well-trodden territory for Amazing Avenue, I know. But I had never really gotten into the Mountain Goats, like, earlier in my life. And Their one of their songs just happened to be in my head the week my son was born, and wound up being like one of his standard lullabies. From there, the song is called "The Best Ever Death Metal Band out of Denton." And which is funny because it ends with him saying Hail Satan, and that's how I put my child to bed. But like, it's a very sweet song. Like, it's not like I'm trying to be bleak about it. It's like I don't know. So then, like, he found out that was a real song, and then we start playing it on Google Home, and then you get the other songs, and it's like, I really dig this band. So the album The Sunset Tree, which I think is maybe, like, sort of generally considered their best or one of their best, but new to me, and I've really enjoyed that. I also wanted to give out, also new to me is books on tape. Like, I've taken to audiobooks for the first time in my life. And I've been listening to Ted Chiang stuff, and there's a Ted Chiang story, the life cycle of software objects, that like just absolutely blew my mind.
I have a perfect recommendation for you then, Ted, which is that John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats is an amazing writer as well, and he has two novels that are available on Audible, both of which are excellent. And he the one is called Wolf in White Van, and that is his first novel, and it's better than anyone's first novel should ever have.
This is gonna make me mad, because that guy already is really good at one thing, yes. Right? Like, why does he get to? Because I'm trying to write fiction, right? And I don't have albums upon albums of beautifully crafted songs. So no, like I don't want that guy to be a good writer. Like I want him to just make good songs.
I just finished the book on tape of his second novel 2 days ago. It's called Universal Harvester. And a lot of it takes place in a video store in the year 2000, which is just like comfort food for me.
Yeah, that's like right. That's my wheelhouse. Yeah, a lot of me took place in a video store in 2000.
Exactly. Yeah. So Universal Harvester and Wolf in White Van by John Darnielle, both excellent, excellent books.
I will check them out.
Okay. Chris.
I was tempted to see if we could get Jeff on Skype there as the Mountain Goats.
Yes,
came into focus.
Yeah, I was thinking about Jeff as it came up.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going with a record that I sort of missed last year. I knew it came out. I have tickets to a show that I love, Bowery Ballroom, but they're holding my tickets hostage basically at this point for a show that would have happened over a year ago and is now scheduled for a little less than a year from today. But all of that aside, Ty Segall is prolific. I think I've probably given a recommendation or two of his records on the show in the past. But the band Fuzz is one of his projects, and he plays drums and sings with two other guys. And the last tour that he came around on before COVID was off a record that he drummed on like some of it, and then, you know, played guitar and other stringed instruments on the rest. But seeing that in person was memorable, just because I've seen Jack White do it too, like years ago with what was that side project he did?
Dirty Weather, was that what it was called?
The Raconteurs, maybe?
No, not the Raconteurs, who I also had seen, but yeah.
Dead Weather,
yes. Where he, you know, he's on drums and he played guitar for like one song, which is the tangent. Anyway, Ty Segall's pretty awesome. Seeing him play drums and sing was a lot of fun during that tour.
Prince, I once saw just like make a tour of the stage, taking everybody's instrument away from them and playing it better than them.
I am so jealous you got to see Prince. I never got to do that.
Twice. I saw Prince twice. Yeah, and just, I mean, spectacular. Spectacular live show.
Yeah, I know someone who was at his final show.
Wow.
Or what turned out to be his final show. And that show was just piano, Prince, and the audience.
Oh, man. That would be.
But yeah, so Ty Segall's in this band called Fuzz. It's one of the many things he's recorded with over the last several years. And they put out an album simply called Three. And I finally got to listen to it just the other night, and it just sounds like, I'd be shocked if it wasn't recorded live. If they did record it in separate parts at all, they did a hell of a job making it just feel like live music was happening coming out of my living room speakers. So yeah, that's my rec this week. Very like Black Sabbath-y riffs, that kind of stuff. Sort of, you know, those roots with Ty Segall's modern take on psychedelic music. And I liked it a lot.
Are bands recording tracks live again? Like, is that come back into? I'm so far out of the world of music. Like, has that? Because I was just randomly thinking about James Brown this morning, and like it was a weird mental tangent, but I was like, well, if you can isolate this James Brown, I was like, oh, but you probably couldn't isolate any James Brown tracks because I assume they recorded all that stuff live. And I was like, well, wait, if it's good enough for James Brown, why can't bands do it now?
I think that the honest answer is just that bands are lazy now, and that it's easier to come, like, you know, all three of us are musicians on this call, and you know, I can play a bass part 90% of the way there live with a band, but if I'm given 100 takes to do it, I can do it 100% of the way there, you know?
Oh, yeah. So you mean the lazy way to do it is like the tracked studio recording?
Yeah, just because you don't have to be as well practiced.
Right, because you can mess up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no. But that's why, that's why James Brown's band could pull off doing it live, right? Because they weren't allowed to mess up.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, not at all. I did have the fortune of seeing him once, was pretty
I've
great.
Also seen, yeah, I also
God
saw
damn,
James
both
Brown.
Both of you.
Yeah.
Cool. It wasn't the best. I'll be honest. It was like a little bit like it wasn't that long before he died. It was like a year before he died, I think. Because he died, I remember he died the same day as Gerald Ford, and I want to say that was like 2005, maybe. And I saw him 2003, and it was fine, you know, like the band was awesome, but he wasn't James Brown like he probably was in the 80s.
That's how I feel. I saw Old Dirty Bastard not long before he died, and I feel like a similar thing. I wish I had seen him 5 years earlier.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So my pick is born out of working from home for a year. I have like four different spots in the house that I do work from, depending on what the kids are doing, if my wife is home, etc. And one of them is in front of the basement television if the upstairs of my house has been kidified. And so I'm always looking for concerts and things to watch on Amazon Prime or YouTube just to have on in the background. And the other day I stumbled across a concert by the short-lived Seattle 90s supergroup Mad Season, which had Layne Staley from Alice in Chains on lead vocals, Mike McCready from Pearl Jam on guitar, and Barrett Martin from Screaming Trees on drums. And the live show is really, really good. And so I started doing some research, and the Mad Season, there was only one Mad Season record, it's called Above, and it came out in 95, and they put out a deluxe version a couple of years ago that has this whole concert as a bonus disc, as well as some tracks they had started with Layne Staley before he died, but were finished by a guy who was the sometime singer in the band, and is also the sometime singer in Queens of the Stone Age. That's Mark Lanegan.
Mark Lanegan, yeah.
Yeah. So Mad Season, Mark Lanegan sings on two songs on the album. I think there's three or four demos that he finished on the deluxe edition of it. And if you know a Mad Season song, you might know River of Deceit, kind of a 90s like alt-rock radio minor hit, but a really solid album. And the live show has a guy named Skerritt on saxophone.
Oh, that's like my percussion. Skerritt was on the track on the album I recommended last time.
I know, that's why I picked it. I was circling around to that. I was saying that. But yeah, Skerritt has played with Les Claypool and lots of other people, and so I thought it was cool that I had wanted to pick that, and then I remembered that Skerritt had played on the thing that you had picked. So
he's like my favorite musician. He's so good.
So, attend with Amazon Prime, Mad Season.
I saw that guy on the street in Park Slope one time, and I stopped him. I was like, "You're Skerritt," and he seemed actually. It's like it's how I feel when Mets fans say hello to me on the street, where it's like it swiftly becomes I'm more excited to talk to them than they are to talk to me because I'm like so psyched to have been recognized, and like that's what it seemed like with Skerritt. He was like, "Oh, cool, man! Do you live around here? What do you play? What do you do?" Yeah, it's like. Because like that's not a guy who gets recognized on the street all that often.
No. So he plays vibraphone, bongos, and sax on this live recording. So all of it's on the Mad Season Above Deluxe Edition, and it also just is a reminder of how tragic the loss of Layne Staley was. And this band was actually started by, so Mike McCready went to rehab after recording Pearl Jam's Vitalogy, and he met a bass player there and brought the bass player back to Seattle. And they were there, they were kind of each other's sober buddies to keep each other on the right path. And McCready was friends with Barrett Martin, who then they started this band, and then they got Layne Staley thinking, if we get Layne into this band, maybe him being around sober folks will help keep him sober.
And it's a classic bad plan.
Yes, it is. And then the bass player actually overdosed on heroin a few years after that as well. So it's a really tragic, sad story, but the album is really good. It's like a bluesier Alice in Chains. And yeah, it's that I think is definitely worth checking out.
But not bluesier Alice in Chains in the way of that one song that's kind of cheesy where they like go into the Guns N' Roses. Well, I got my woman, I got my show.
No. Okay. I believe you're referring to Don't Follow.
Yeah.
From Jar
right.
of Flies. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
This has been three guys from the 90s talking about Alice in Chains.
What do you guys think about Mudhoney?
I love Mudhoney.
Touch me, I'm sick.
They are a blast live, and Mark Arm is the best. It just is like a dude. We're going deeper into this. Brian and I think I already talked about it, but Mopop.
I know I was pressing a specific button.
Oh,
I
yes,
was
you
just
are.
Pressing a button. Yeah.
But wait, hold on. I'll try to keep it concise. But there, Mopop, this awesome museum in Seattle, did like a career achievement sort of award for a different band each year, and they did Alice in Chains during the pandemic. A lot of bands did covers. They put this whole thing together. It was really cool. And in it, Mark Arm just did like a quick little, you know, recorded on Zoom at home kind of like video congratulations to them. And his dog was the most ridiculous little dog. And it was just perfect. Like they were the same level of white. Their hair was similar. It was this little poopy dog. But Mark Arm is also awesome, not only from the Mudhoney shows I've seen where they put on a hell of a show, but back when All Tomorrow's Parties was still a festival, and it happened in Monticello, I went once. And Mudhoney played, and Iggy and the Stooges played in the same night. And when, you know, Mudhoney did their set, there may have been one band in between. But then during the Stooges set, I look over, it's me and my cousin, and on our right is Mark Arm in the crowd, like getting into it. He just like everybody else. And I always, I'll always remember that and respect it because, you know, he had just performed. He obviously could be recognized by everybody there, but he was not above getting into the fray and just being a Stooges fan like everybody else in the room. So that is my Mark Arm story.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a thing that sometimes you see at festivals is you get to see like the bands getting down on the other bands. And that's like one of the great pleasures of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, Ted, there's like 50 bands you could have said in that moment that one of us would have had a similar like reaction to. So,
well, did Chris also jump in with Mark Lanegan when I said Mark Lanegan?
Yes. Yes.
Oh okay. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. It's like
everyone. I saw Mudhoney, or did I see Mudhoney or Meat Puppets with Jay Jaffe? I think it was Meat Puppets we saw together. Maybe it was both.
That's funny.
I believe you. Yeah.
That's funny. Well, Ted, if people have Mark Lanegan takes, where can they find you on the internet to share them with you?
I am on Twitter at OG Ted Berg, and they can email. I'm at asktedberg@gmail.com.
Everybody check out Metrospectives, and you know, as always, check out the other Amazing Avenue podcasts, a pod of their own, Unformatable, From Complex to Queens. We are proud of all of our shows, even if Ted makes fun of us for having a lot of them.
Yeah, they're all good. I'm not saying they're not good. You just have a lot of shows.
Hey. Spoiler alert,
we're trying to compete here, right? Like, I'm trying to take down the Amazing Avenue podcast empire, and you guys put on a new show every day. What am I supposed to do? I got kids to feed, you know, I gotta take care of these kids.
You can find our shows on Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, you can find them there. You can find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. Chris is at Chris McShane. I am at Brian Needs a Nap. Thank you, Ted. And until next time, let's go Mets.